Hello?
Who's this?
Who are you trying to reach?
Wait, I was just wondering what you're doing tonight.
Just getting ready to listen to a podcast.
Ooh, you like podcasts? What's your favorite podcast?
Oh, just Percolated Media's Three Men in a Retrospective podcast where they look at various franchises one film at a time.
Really? Is that the one with Garrett, Adam, and Matt?
Yeah, this next month and a half, they'll be looking at the Scream series, where two of them haven't watched past the fourth film of the series.
You never told me your name.
Why do you want to know my name?
Because I want to know who I'm looking at.
Scream 3 released February 4th. 2000. Budget on this was $40 million. Box office $72 million stateside, $161.8 million total. And this is directed by Mr. Wes Craven. All right. Well, after two of us were pretty harsh on Scream 2, one of us actually really liked Scream 2. Here we are, 3 years later, and everybody's egos are completely inflated. We have almost nobody who wanted to be here back 3 years later. Adam, as somebody who had not seen this yet, what were you expecting coming in, sir?
I had no clue. I figured this is where this had to jump to the shark because I think I mentioned last week, the only thing I remember from this movie is the picture of Courtney Cox's bangs. Like, that is all I remember. Nothing else. And if that's what stuck with me 20 years later, it can't have been a great thing. But I've never seen it. I didn't know what the story was or who was in it other than the obvious players. So I was ready to go though, and here we are.
Here we are. All right, Matt. Any high hopes, even after me and you reviewed this a number of years ago, were you hoping that you would at least feel a little more positive about it?
I barely remember even watching this. That's how long it's been. Because we did that, what, a year after COVID started? So it's been
Yeah.
like damn near 5 years at this point. And I have not watched it since, largely because of that last viewing. I wasn't going to put myself through this again because we have so much going on. But when we made the decision to put this back on the slate with number seven almost upon us, less than a week out, it's impossible to ignore this. You got to rewatch all of them. You got to make sure that we don't skip any entries because, well, we're completionists. But unlike two, which has largely its reputation has kind of flatlined since it's come out, like I don't really think it's gotten reappraised or anything like that. This one kind of, and this is why I was curious to go back and watch it. I don't want to say it's getting reevaluated as far as like quality, but from a contextual standpoint, there's certainly a lot more to talk about than even 5 years ago when we reviewed it.
For sure. Absolutely. There's a lot of context added to this since we did that review. There's just so much to talk about. Let's talk about, well, we got to bring up something that we tend to do almost as much as we bring up 9/11 on these podcasts, and that is something known as the Columbine High School Massacre. So, in the pre-stages of this, Kevin Williamson did write an outline for it, and they were all set to make it more bloody, more violent than ever before. And then Columbine happened, and producers got cold feet on this, and they're like, we got to bring this in a more comedic direction. And Wes Craven said, this is a horror series. I want to bring the horror to it. And at that point, the producers brought in Aaron Kruger, Matt. We've talked about him. They brought him in to kind of brush up on Kevin Williamson's outlines. Guess what? He threw out Kevin Williamson's outlines. And this reminds me of when we did Empire Strikes Back a few years ago, and George Lucas had brought in a definitely a more established writer by the name of Lee Brackett to do a script of that, and he read it and he was very upset at how his characters were treated in that script. He didn't think there was any voice carried on from the previous entry, and he had to really do a lot of rewrites along with Lawrence Kasdan to get that to work. Problem with Scream 3, it doesn't have a Lawrence Kasdan. We have Wes Craven here, who was the one who did the rewrites on this. Adam, do you remember hearing about any of this when this was coming out?
I don't know if I remember it specifically for this, but it was the problems of the times. I mean, I think we were together buying an album, and I was buying the Matrix soundtrack and something else, and a lady stopped me and started yelling that I was the reason Columbine happened was because of people like me, because I was buying the Matrix soundtrack and God, it was something else that came out that same time. So it was, sorry, so, I mean, shit still happens, you know, horribly. So it's amazing to think that, you know, oh, it's a time and place because this fucking country hasn't changed in that respect. But it was massive part of the news coverage. So I'm not surprised. I don't remember it specifically for this, but that makes sense.
Now, Matt, you were about 6 or 7 when this thing was coming out, but just in the context of what you're familiar with as far as, you know, nowadays, we hear a lot about violence in society, but we don't really hear about its effects in the Hollywood productions. Had you heard that Columbine had pretty much changed the trajectory of this entry?
No, I didn't know that because A, my age, and B, I didn't think that a horror movie, because that's kind of the genre where you can, if not justify a lack of changes, you can at least, it's hard to compare it to current events just based on what the genre entails. You know, it's not like a documentary or a drama or a comedy where I think people are much more conscious and sensible when you need to change things in the wake of real life circumstances. This one in particular, no, but it's also worth noting in the wake of, because Adam was talking about how he was the problem, basically. I'm pretty sure he was also holding a copy of Grand Theft Auto when that woman was yelling at him, because it was rap music, it was grunge, and it was video games that were going to be the end of American society.
Thank you, Tipper Gore.
Yeah, I was just about to reference her. I'm pretty sure she should have had an executive producer credit on this thing. I think the scariest thing in this movie is seeing Aaron Kruger's name as the sole credited screenwriter, because not only has this man in large caused me a great deal of cinematic pain with those Transformers sequels. I know he's not the sole writer on all those, but I think he takes a fair share of the blame. It's the same man who wrote such classics as Reindeer Games, Arlington Road, and the worst thing Terry Gilliam has ever made, The Brothers Grimm.
I would vouch for Arlington Road. I actually really like that film. But Reindeer Games, I haven't seen since its initial release. He was fired off this production to do that for the Weinsteins. So, yeah, I'm very familiar with Kruger's work. It's just funny to me that someone named Kruger is working for Wes Craven. That just always made me laugh.
I think that's why you hired him.
Because he got the job.
Because I don't think Craven, bless his soul, I don't think he oftentimes knew what a good script entailed.
Nope. And like I said, he was the one who had to do the rewrites of this thing to give it a connective voice to the previous entries. And yeah, you're right. As much as we talk about Craven, how good he was at directing that first film, and to a certain extent last week's film, sir, you were no Shakespeare.
No, but also we should mention, speaking of the writing, this is the only one I believe in the series that Kevin Williamson has no writing credit on.
Yep.
Yeah.
Because he sort of kind of got priced out because he had done I Know What You Did Last Summer. He was doing that Wasteland was that TV show he was working on. It didn't last that long. But he had his hands in a lot of different pies. And quite frankly, I don't blame him for wanting to stretch out. Although he really only stretched as far from like your elbow to your wrist because he went from Scream to a Scream knockoff as his primary big project. And I can't believe it's 2026 and within the last year we have a new I Know What You Did Last Summer and a new Scream movie.
Yeah, he was also doing Dawson's Creek at this time, and the Weinsteins finally gave the green light to Teaching Mrs. Tingle for him to do his directorial debut on. So yeah, he was like, I can't do this. I'm not going to come back for this. And you reap what you sow. I mean, this is the result of him leaving the project, and we'll talk about whether it's at least watchable. Adam, you had heard that Kevin Williamson had nothing to do with this project. Did that worry you at all?
A little bit, but when you're 3 movies into something, that should be about when you're ready to change. I was more surprised that Wes Craven was still attached to this than I was Williamson leaving, just because it seemed like that time.
Well, yeah, he was trying to get out of the horror genre for quite a number of years up until this. In fact, the only reason he took this project, the only reason he said yes to this, was because the Weinsteins had promised him Music of the Heart with Meryl Streep, which was his venture away from horror, and it did give Meryl Streep yet another Oscar nomination, but in a lot of ways, that might be the scariest movie he's ever made.
It's also the only movie he's made that is not a horror or thriller
yeah,
of any kind.
Yeah.
I mean, the scariest thing about that movie is the fact that it's not great, and I don't understand why. Like, it was that, like, we just give Meryl Streep an Oscar just for showing up.
I was going to say, that's the only reason she would get an Oscar is because she was in something. In fact, Craven tried getting her to make an appearance in this in the Carrie Fisher role, but she said no to that.
It's also weird that he would stick around for this, because every other, I guess, architect of these horror franchises left to do other things. John Carpenter didn't stick around with Halloween. Friday the 13th went through as many hands as Jason went through machetes. And outside of Wes Craven and like Don Mancini, those are really the only two I can think of where you have the same creative voice. And even then, with Craven, I think the only reason he stopped making them is because he passed away.
Yeah, he was going to do Scream 5. We'll talk about that next week. Let's also talk about who was supposed to be our main star of this. She kind of takes a back seat. Neve Campbell, she was another one who had a whole bunch. She had other things going on at the time this was made. She initially said no, but they convinced her to come back, but she was only going to give them 20 days. Dewey and Gale pretty much take center stage. Party of Five was still going on, but she also had Drowning Mona filming at the same time. So everything was just kind of happening at once for her. Adam, had you heard that Neve Campbell was kind of not as prevalent in this one?
Yeah, that was one of the things I knew, was that it was trying to steer away from the Sidney Prescott of it all and move on past it. I get not a surprise when you're this far deep into a franchise. You know, how much can you, you know, thinking of I Know What You Did Last Summer. You know, how long are you going to keep playing the same kids with the same jokes every single freaking year? Well, sometimes you saw it up and do the same things to the same people. But yeah, it was time to move past Sidney, I think, anyway, if they were going to keep this going. So I thought.
And unlike the other horror franchises where you don't have a lot of principal characters you can pass them off to because they get killed when you lose your final girl, this one you had a built-in justification to not have her at all if you wanted to, because you still had Gale and Dewey to pick up the slack. And I don't think people would have cried foul if she wasn't in it, if you made the story independent of her association. And we also have to talk about David Arquette had some other things going on in the year 2000.
Oh, no. Well, that was later on in the year, but yeah.
No, but what I'm saying is Courtney Cox was still in the midst of Friends. That wouldn't end for another 4 years. So within a couple months, David Arquette would go from the co-lead in Scream 3 to the co-lead of Ready to Rumble to WCW World Heavyweight Champion. And that is the least embarrassing thing on his resume of those three.
Yeah, David Arquette, at this point, too, he was front row, all the Nitros. He was a huge fan, and they would call it out that, yeah, he's going to be in Scream. And this thing did make a lot of money. I mean, it is one of the most looked down upon of all the sequels, but it did gross over $160 million. No wonder why they were wanting to make another one. So,
well, they also got a lot of licensing money from the soundtrack for this movie, which was part of the, to a lesser degree, the previous two movies, but now we're at the time where selling a soundtrack was almost as important as selling the feature film that it's associated with. And goddamn, you can tell this came out in 2000 when the number one single on it is Creed.
Oh, yes.
Which is funny because Liev Schreiber played a character named Creed in X-Men.
Oh, shit.
I had that album too, believe it or not.
You know what's funny? I give Creed a lot of shit. I kind of like that song.
I like that song too. I remember WWE used to play it.
Oh God, look at this. Like Creed, Seven Dust, Limp Bizkit. Like between this and The Punisher 2004, we're going through all of WWE's pay-per-view songs.
Yeah,
or bands that they hired, like post-Attitude.
All right. Well, unless anybody has anything else to add, I'm going to get right into this plot because...
Well, there is one other thing that I think really kind of hurt this movie.
Go.
Came out the same year as Scary Movie.
It did. Which was Weinstein still.
Yes.
We start off, we're looking at the Hollywood sign through a helicopter when we're hearing about a multiple injury accident as our non-killer Cotton Weary is feeling the effects of it by being stuck in traffic. He's making calls, looking to his agent as a seeming stalker call comes through, which Cotton relishes in. He tells his agent he'll call her back as the voice says that she's a Cotton fan, and she asks what his girlfriend would say, and it's revealed that this is actually Ghostface standing right outside his girlfriend's shower. All right, so a couple of things about this. They were just going to do this as Cotton and Cotton only being killed here. When they started putting this scene together, they realized that it would not be that suspenseful to have this wiry ghost face be standing next to big buff fucking Liev Schreiber here, because he was starting to work out for roles at this time. Kelly Weatherford was literally hired probably a week before this movie started. We're going to talk about another character here that was hired the day before this movie started. And so she was hired to literally be the one who was put in distress Adam, did you feel that this girlfriend character was kind of added last minute?
I feel like there was a complete disconnect, almost where it was filmed separately and wasn't planned together, because the cotton stuff seems to be, I mean, you could almost put a wall between him and his girlfriend. I know they're in car in separate areas, but it feels separated.
Yeah, what also doesn't help, of the three, this one has the, I would call, the hackiest editing job. And it's weird to say that, because this is the editor who did, like, basically everything Craven made.
Mm-hmm.
Same one as the first two.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, this one kind of, the editing mirrors the production, where it feels really choppy. And honestly, the color grading on these two, when they cut back and forth, it doesn't even look like you're watching the same movie. And the most unrealistic thing in this entire series is he beats LA traffic to get back home. I'm sorry, that is 100% bullshit that he's able to get home within that time limit if you know anything about deadlock traffic in Los Angeles.
Very true, but as somebody who lived in Los Angeles for a number of years, I will say it is accurate as far as where it's located and where he says he's going. That's all accurate. So the fact that it's unrealistic how he gets there, at least they got the placement correct. So Ghostface demands to know where Sydney is, and when Cotton refuses to say, the voice says wrong answer and hangs up. This causes Cotton to panic, so he makes his way out of traffic, as Matt said, and he's trying to call his girlfriend's phone. She's getting dressed as Cotton calls 911, and as we've mentioned, Creed is playing in the background. Cotton's girlfriend thinks that he's here and playing games with her, so she tries calling him out, and she hears who she thinks is Cotton's voice. All right, here we go. Matt, you called out what you think is the most unrealistic thing about this franchise. As I've mentioned 100 times in this retrospective, I haven't seen 5 on, but I have to say that the most science fiction thing they have done so far is the fact that they can actually disguise their voice as the other character's voice.
Nowadays, this would be a lot easier to swallow, given technology and deep fakes and all that kind of stuff. In 2000, The Matrix was more realistic than this. And one of the problems I have with this movie is it uses this literal device to cheat in a lot of the writing. And in particular, to cheat in how certain events happen. And I think it's a very lazy trope that the movie quickly overuses.
But this is actually Ghostface, who's still clumsy, falling all around. She knocks Ghostface down, and he's still pretending to be Cotton, saying how fun it's going to be to rip her insides out as he stabs through the door. Cotton gets home, as we see Cotton is also on the TV in the same suit. He looks for her as he grabs a fire pick and moves through the house. He spots stab marks in the door, so he opens it, calling Chris's name. He bursts through, and it's Chris who comes barreling out of the closet, telling him to stay back. She, of course, thinks it's Ghostface, so she pushes him down as Ghostface approaches her from behind and stabs her. Cotton is then knocked down as Ghostface says it was simple. All he had to do was say where Sydney was and then kills him.
So, narrative flaw we have to address right now before we even get into when we find out who the Ghostface is. Why would he suspect that Cotton still keeps in touch with Sydney? You know, they buried the hatchet. They got, like, a Hallmark level of forgiveness in the second movie. But the movie never establishes, like, they were friends afterwards or kept in touch. So it feels like this is just for a Ghostface who, as we'll find out, is like a Blofeld level of master manipulator. This seems like a lot of work that could have been prevented.
How do you feel about the kill overall, though?
This one, and it starts immediately, I think the kills in this one, they're consistently the same. So they get a high mark for consistency, but it's literally just almost 90% of the time it's people just getting stabbed and falling over. Not a whole lot of creativity in this one, which is sadly a mission statement you could stamp on this on Ghostface's oversized forehead.
I actually like this opening just because I wasn't expecting what we got. To open with Cotton was shocking to me. And I feel like this is just a quick start, really jumps right into it. And I know they all start with a kill, but this was just it. If you would have asked me how this thing would have started before I watched it, never would have guessed this is how they went. So on that end, I'm all for it. The voice changer thing bugs me at the beginning, bugs me by the end of this. But other than that, I actually think this is it's a way to start that threw me off any type of expectations. And in that respect, it was effective.
Yeah, I'm more on Adam's side here. I don't think this opening is too bad. Now, it's not part one good, but it's not part two bad. I think it's dead in the center of the three films that we've seen so far.
I think it's more just dead.
Well, speaking of dead, we then see Sydney. She shows up for work at a woman's crisis center. And again, I want to give another compliment. I think this is an extremely plausible place for Sydney to land. And I agree with this particular writing choice. You know, it was said that Krueger, when he got... I just can't say Krueger's name without fucking chuckling.
Can't help but laugh.
I know. When he got Williamson's outline, he threw out those outlines and he did just a bunch of character work that really had no real voice. I feel like this might be a Craven choice to have her work at this Women's Crisis Center, and I agree with it. I think it's a good place to start her off at.
I agree. I think the easy thing would have been, and I think most writers would take her into the victim mentality again, or... some type of just, you know, kind of what we got with Jamie Lee Curtis in that final trilogy that they did, the reboot, the third reboot, where she was just a shut in and gone crazy. But I appreciate that we still have a Sydney that's capable, that's strong, and is so much more than your final girl trope. And I fucking love that. I really do.
You know, for a movie that Craven did not direct, but still had a hand in, this reminds me a lot of what they did with Nancy and Dream Warriors. You know, taking what she's learned and is applying it to help others. And it's good because it doesn't make you feel like she is going through the motions or remaining ignorant. No, she's actually in a genre where intelligence is about as hard to find as it is in our current White House. This is a good thing to see for them to keep track of. Like, I think character consistency for Sydney, for being three movies in, is pretty on track. And I don't think it goes off the beaten path. What I don't like, though, is that she looks like she lives in a fucking Grape Nuts commercial, just out in the middle of nowhere. Like, I half expect her to be sitting on a porch with a dog eating the world's most disgusting cereal.
Yeah, how the hell does she afford this place? That's what I want to know. This place must really pay well.
I don't know. You know, maybe her dad left her a lot of money, but we'll never know because he's disappeared from the series.
Gone.
Yeah, was that due to, like, contract disputes? Because he never... To my recollection, he doesn't come back.
Her mother keeps being a part of the series, and dad is never mentioned again.
And he's the one that's still 6 feet above the ground.
You know what, Matt? I was expecting, right after Adam said that, I was expecting you to say, stay quiet, you'll find out. But what you're saying is he's written out for the rest of the series. Oh, that's bad.
Well, I honestly don't remember if he comes back.
Okay, so... Sydney gets a call from an 18-year-old girl, and she starts crying as we cut away to the scariest part of this film, Courtney Cox and her hair. You know, Matt, until we covered this series the first time, I had never noticed this, but our third of that series pointed it out as we reviewed this movie, and my God, it's in my face like Ghostface's knife was in Cotton's in the opening 10 minutes of this film. This hair is bad. And apparently this was the idea of David Arquette. David Arquette was the one who said, I think it would be cool if you look like Betty Page throughout this thing, and that's how they cut her hair, and the cast had to kind of pretend, oh, that's a really good look for you, and they were kind of snickering behind their back. This is just a bad look.
Yeah, apparently her hairstylist wasn't going to be there for her, because holy crap, this is an eyesore the likes of which you... I guess this is the equivalent of, like, hair and makeup of Henry Cavill's mustache.
Yes.
Like, this is the female equivalent where you can't look away.
I guess Arquette knew that the wedding wasn't going great by this point, so he wanted to make sure nobody else would be interested in Cox. Because, geez, don't do this to your wife, man. Oh, it's bad.
I'll give her this, and David Arquette. I think her and Arquette are the only two people of the original cast who really want to be here. You know, I think that kind of shows, but yeah, fire that stylist. Gail is speaking and is asked a question about the stabbings, and the guy is quickly cut off. We then meet Martin Kincaid, played by Patrick Dempsey, who tells Gail that Cotton has been murdered. Now, this Patrick Dempsey, this was the character I mentioned earlier. This was the actor who was hired literally like 2 days before this. Oh, boy, does that show.
Yes, and this was before Grey's Anatomy.
Yes.
Because around this time, people thought, like, he was going to be a bigger star than what he was. Because he had, like, you know, Can't Buy Me Love and... a couple other roles in the late 80s. Yeah, Loverboy, The Escape. Like, people thought he was going to be, like, the next, I don't know, boy next door type. And it just never permeated until Grey's Anatomy became wrong. I think he's fine. You know, he doesn't bother me. It's just funny that I saw him in Eli Roth's Thanksgiving a couple years ago, and he got to play the slasher villain, spoilers. Whereas here, it's so obvious they're trying to make you be like, okay, he's not the fucking killer. But by doing so, they make him too milquetoast. And borderline is a romance whenever he's clearly infatuated with Sydney.
Well, to define the frantic nature of the writing of this film, disappears throughout this movie, and he's pretty much forgotten about by the script writers. They did not bring him back. Craven was the one who was like, you have this Kincaid character, this Patrick Dempsey, are we going to bring him into the finale of this thing? And I was like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. So they frantically put him back in into the third act. I think that shows, I think you're exactly right, he's just written to be a foil here, and he is kind of given the whole is he or isn't he the killer. And yeah, I had just watched Thanksgiving this year for the very first time, so I was thinking about that too. I'm like, oh boy, I guess he's always played this. No, it's just as we say red herring.
That's all he's here for, is I feel, is to be a red herring. So 3 for 3. I also just watched Thanksgiving last year. I feel like he is playing the same character in both for the most part, other than, you know, the turn spoiler that you get in there. But holy crap, he plays them both the same way. He's 20 years apart. I mean, okay, you got Dempsey. Was John Cusack not available? or was it just because at that time, if you got John, you got Joan as well, and they didn't have a role? It feels a weird inclusion, and you might as well have cast his name as Red Herring, because this is when it starts that every freaking character feels like a red herring. And I know that's a point of the series, but everybody feels like a red herring from here on out, including, I don't know, Jay and Silent Bob.
All right, we're getting there. Hold your thoughts on that.
Yeah, we also have to hold thoughts on one thing I need to remind people. This character is a cop.
Yes.
Put a pin in that.
I'm sorry to people who haven't seen Thanksgiving yet. We just completely spoiled that. But you've had a few years. Okay, so Kincaid says that he's sharing this with her because she knew him, but she can't share it with anyone else. Speaking of Cotton. And Kincaid then shows her a picture of Sydney's mom as we cut to Sydney seeing the story on the news. We then cut to Sunshine Studios and the production of Stab 3. And anyone who has listened to this podcast for any length of time or has followed my reviews on Letterboxd, they know that this is my Achilles heel when it comes to plots and movies. Very rarely has the idea of showing the making of a movie within a movie worked for me, and I can't think of a time when it worked in the horror genre. Matt and I have reviewed a number of those. And when you have Craven doing this, who had already failed at the meta card when he did New Nightmare 6 years before this, according to me and Matt, Adam would beg to differ on that one. I'm already taking back the goodwill for this movie that the first 15 minutes or so had built up. We're seeing the making of a movie within a movie, and I never fucking liked that.
Oh, no, 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 no. Stop. Look, you can fool me once, fool me twice. You keep doing this over and over. You lose every effectiveness that it has, and then I doubt everything the rest of the movie, but not in the fun way. I'm just annoyed. And just because you did Nightmare, who delves with this in a wonderful, brilliant way until you don't do it here. Just don't. And as wonderful and greatly meta as New Nightmare is, I don't want this in this film because it just fucking rips me out.
Oh boy. This is one of those instances where you're seeing the delineation with sequels. The first one is a masterstroke as far as its uncanny ability to both pay homage to the horror genre while also, if not satirizing it, you're exposing it. It's sort of like breaking kayfabe, to use another wrestling term, where it's like, hey, even if you're not a hardcore movie buff, we're going to deconstruct horror in a way that we're pointing all this stuff out. Second one kind of loses focus on horror specifically, and they talk more about sequels in general. This one is not only offers little in the way of commentary on horror, it also starts adding stuff that, as we'll talk about when it's included, has nothing to do with the horror genre at large and a lot of capabilities, independent of the whole production within a movie, which I'm also annoyed by because the second one kind of tries to do that with the opening of that film, having a movie within a movie. Mm-hmm. So now you're taking it one step further, but it's not only not clever when it talks about, okay, now we're going to do what the first one did and kind of deconstruct horror. They're painting with too broad of a brush. And as a result, it stops being commentary, horror commentary, and just becomes Hollywood patting itself on the back. And in a lot of ways, in an uncomfortable way, once we talk about some of the subtext.
We get arms crossing security guards as Roger Corman is here, as well as Lance Henriksen, and they talk to Scott Foley. Remember when he was a thing, guys? This was his first film.
Was this his first, really?
Yeah, this was his first.
I mean, I guess it makes sense because he was much more of a TV actor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, speaking of Dawson's Creek, and that's why they didn't get Kevin Williamson, but they got someone from the first season of that show, and he was also on Grey's Anatomy.
We see the complaining African-American guy named Tyson Fox, who's played by Dion Richmond, who is playing a version of Randy, as well as Angelina Tyler, Christ, these names, played by Emily Mortimer, and Sarah Darling, played by Jenny McCarthy. They go over their lines, and they all complain together. And then, of course, you know, we got to get out there that, oh, my lines are being rewritten on the day, because we got to call out the fact that this thing just, it was rewritten up to the nth hour. We then see Gail approached by the woman playing her, saying that she feels like after two films, she was in her mind, and Gail responds, that would explain my headache. And this is who we'll know as Jennifer Jolie, oy vey, played by Parker Posey. Meaning, as much as I love Posey as an actress, after this and Superman Returns, I'm yet again going to spend this entire podcast ripping into her. Stay tuned to future podcasts to hear what I think of her in Blade 3. Adam, how do you feel about Parker Posey in this?
You already skipped to Blade 3. I like Parker Posey, but all of this with the lines and them casting, and I just, it's gone into slapstick, and it's not a meta commentary on the movie. I feel like it's spoofing Scary Movie at this point. It's eating its own tail, and I don't care for it. And I feel like the acting from these people is horrendous.
Yes. And you could have gotten away with that if that was the joke, that they were so desperate to cash in on the murders and everything that happened that they hired actors on the cheap who suck at their job but are just there because they're pretty and cheap. But no, I don't think they realize that. And everyone in this movie, as far as the new cast, are probably the biggest detriment because none of them are interesting. They're all very one note. And in the case of Parker Posey, I don't like that she's attached to Gail at the hip because it stops being funny after the first 30 seconds. It's almost like she's like an anchor dragging down everything that Gail does.
This is when we see Dewey, once again played by David Arquette, as Jennifer tells her that Dewey has made her know the real Gail. Dewey says that he's the technical advisor as Tom Prince. Get it, guys? Tom Cruise, Freddie Prince. He shows up. Adam, how'd you feel about the reappearance of Dewey here? You've been the least fan of Dewey this entire series so far. How do you feel he is in this?
I'd like this, you know, kind of change up for him. I feel like he at least has growth by this point that we haven't seen with some of the other ones. I like the separation. I like that he's actually gotten to mature and do things a little bit different. So I like that he's changed off a little bit.
Gail laughs at the fact that Tom is playing Dewey, and here comes Lance Henriksen to kick Gail's ass off the set. And Adam, as you mentioned, here come the Weinsteins to congratulate themselves because we have a Jay and Silent Bob cameo, which comes out of nowhere. And even in this few seconds, I want them off the fucking screen. I hate this so much.
Well, I don't even like Jay and Silent Bob in the movies that they were in before
exactly. They
got their own movie. So I've never liked them to begin with. And this is between this and something else we're going to talk about. If this was in Scary Movie, I would expect it. But the fact that it's in the movie that we're supposed to take on some degree seriously, just a bad call.
Well, it just goes to what I talked about at the beginning here. We are trying to make this more comedic. We're trying to give a more comedic movie as opposed to the violence that was displayed the year prior in the massacre we discussed earlier. So I literally feel like that's the only reason they're here. And I just don't like that. Adam, as the lone Kevin Smith fan on this podcast, what'd you feel about when they came out of nowhere? Did you have any idea this was happening?
I had forgotten that this was a thing. Once this happened, I suddenly reverted back 20 years and went, oh, I remember when they had talked about doing this, and I think they'd even done a commercial on MTV for this. So I remembered it in reverse, and I don't think it's needed. I think it's a bad idea, and I think it was done just to show that the Weinsteins had no idea where to sell and how they were going to sell a third installment of this, which is funny because Weinstein sure as puts himself in this movie a little bit later, but this is, it's a weird inclusion. Yes, I'm a massive Jay and Silent Bob fan, and this has no place in this film.
Sydney asks her dad if he ever thinks of her mom and then why he has so many secrets. You know, it's a shame that Neve Campbell only gave them 20 days because I do really like the stuff that she's involved with in this movie. Adam, how do you feel about Neve Campbell here?
I think she's fantastic. I like that she's trying to help other people that have gone through trauma or other victims. I think that is fantastic. I think she continuously really tries. And I think the mainstays are trying. I think Courtney Cox is trying, but is attempting to do something with a character that I just don't like. I think David Arquette actually, just like in The Squared Circle, he's coming to play. And I think that Neve Campbell, I think she feels like this is her series as much as it is Wes Craven's. And I admire the hell out of her for it. And I think she's right.
I kind of wish they did a binary all or nothing, either make her the focal point or don't have her at all. Because I feel like this compromise hinders the writing because it makes Gale, and to a certain much larger degree, Gale kind of one note. And they try to compensate by giving the mom posthumously a bigger role. And I think it creates a ton of problems as a result.
We see a picture of Sydney and her mom, as wouldn't you know it, Craven just can't resist the urge to show Sydney having a nightmare about her mom coming to the window proclaiming Sydney to be poisoned just like her. She's jolted awake by the idea of Ghostface being there slicing at her as the dog gets up and leaves the room. We then see Sarah show up to set looking for Roman, and gee guys, I wonder if she dies here. They prolong this death forever with jump scares and peeking around corners. Some would call that suspense. I would personally say it's making this movie unnecessarily long. They should have killed this bitch 5 minutes in at the most. I hate this in order
to build suspense, you have to at least first possess it.
That's true. Matt, how'd you feel about this death?
I think I just gave my answer, Your Honor. I will vacate the rest of my time.
All right. Adam?
Oh, my God. I don't even want this in the movie. I want this to be... Show this as part of the movie within a movie, because I don't want to see it. This drags and slows this down. You know, the good part is she's gone.
Well, even more so than the second one, this cast is so bloated, it might as well be sitting in the Oval Office right now. There are so many freaking characters in this movie, and half of them I don't even remember their names. I feel like a producer showing up on the set where it's like, who is that?
Look, I hate that we mention it, but it needs to bear repeating. I feel like they walk off the set of Scary Movie to film Scream.
It feels like they borrowed the sets.
Yeah.
Film Stab, actually. It feels like the movie that they're making within the movie.
Yeah, but it feels like Scary Movie.
Of course, Sarah's calling out that she's the chick who's killed second in only two scenes. That's exactly what happens to her. Ha ha. She also calls out that she's 35 playing a 20-year-old. Jenny McCarthy was 27 at the time they filmed this.
Yeah, anti-vax years, so it's tough on her.
Gale talks to Dewey about why she's here and calls out Dewey for leaving Woodsboro. She says that they didn't work even if they tried. They're just too different. Stay tuned for next week.
Yeah, it's funny how these four movies between the next one mirror real life.
Dewey says all this isn't just about her, and then says off the record that he has evidence that says Sid is being stalked by someone on the film. Dewey then walks into Jennifer while she's having a joint, and they hear that Sarah Darling has been murdered.
See, here's the other problem. You have her smoking a joint, and you've already shown Jay and Silent Bob. If you were going to have them in the movie, this was the scene to put them in.
Gale sees that she's the one who gets killed third in Stab 3, and Gale is shocked that Dewey lives there. He says that Jennifer tells him that she likes having him there because he's her rock. And then we hear that Dewdrop, as Patrick Warburton calls him, gets stopped. And then Patrick Warburton asks for Dewey to stop taking suggestions from him since Dewey is now the celebrity hanger-on. Kincaid says that Jennifer is next to be killed in this script, though it's hard to tell which script the killer is going by. Get it, guys? Because they're calling out that this thing had a lot of rewrites going on.
I'm sorry, just because you're calling it out doesn't give you an excuse to pass it off as, oh, it's not our fault. Absolutely. If anything, you're just highlighting it more.
Exactly. Roman
thought to hire Welbert for this film? I mean, to have Putty show up.
You know who they wanted?
No.
Stone Cold Steve Austin. Swear to Christ.
What?
Yes. He said no, so they went with Patrick Warburton for this.
Oh, this is the one time he said, what, was he going to do the Condemned 4? Was that what he needed to do at this point? Because he knew that, was he jealous of the new WCW champion?
Who the hell knows?
Oh, God.
No, because he was out. He was out. He had his neck surgery. He was home recovering at this point.
Let's see. Yeah, you're right. This was a month in. Yep. Although this was probably filmed before that, so who the hell knows? Roman seems to think that he's next, but Roman's being interrogated because Sarah's last call was to him. Sydney takes a call at her crisis hotline from someone using her mother's voice who claims to have killed somebody. She then tells Sydney to be a good girl and then turn on the news. Ghostface then asks Sydney if she thinks that it's really over. We then see Steve Stone guarding the outside as scripts are being gone over and ripped apart. We're hearing that Tom asked Angelina out and was turned down flat. And then we see that Gail is spying on Jennifer and Dewey as Dewey unleashes his feelings for Gail on her. Steve then grabs Gail and tells Dewdrop that he caught her eavesdropping. She tells Dewey that the phone they tracked is untraceable, and Gail can't find any information on Maureen at the age of 19 or 20, like she fell into a black hole and vanished. So we are taking the small bit of story from the first film, which is Maureen, Sydney's mom, and we are just blowing it up for this film.
I'm okay at first, really delving into Sydney's mom and what happened, because that was the part of the reveal. Where they take it, I get angry at this film. I get mad and I resent the Weinstein name being on this film with the way that they take that character as a woman in Hollywood and the shit that has gone on. I think it, especially in hindsight, is pretty freaking disgusting.
Yeah, you took a conversation point that I was going to get to later, but it is uncanny how much this mirrors real life by the end. In fact, this is the one that you look back on, I think it ages the worst.
This thing is one step away from making Natalie Wood jokes.
Yeah.
Because that's what they do to Sydney's mom, and it's holy shit.
Dewey matches the pictures of Jennifer with Maureen taken at the back lot. We see Steve take a call from Dewdrop as he goes through pictures looking for a killer. Speaking of which, Ghostface appears behind Steve and then takes him out. So bye, Patrick Warburton.
Yeah, that was putty disappointing.
Dewey then almost shoots everyone as they start showing up and then walks outside to see Steve collapse in front of him. He goes back inside where the lights go out. The phone rings indicating a fax has shown up, and it ends up being a page in the script. They read it, and what is going on, guys? What is happening at this point? They split up as Tom blows up the set and himself. Man, this explosion was huge.
Why do they have explosives on a movie that's satirizing the Woodsboro murders when there were no bombs going off?
It's insane. Dewey falls down a hill as he hears the girl's voices from a distance. Gail is approached by Ghostface. Dewey sees it and shoots at him as he falls down yet another hill. There are zero traces of Ghostface near the car as Dewey asks Gail if she's all right, and Gail thanks him for saving her. Jennifer then shows up and takes a swipe at Dewey as Gail takes a swipe at her. Angelina then shows up out of nowhere asking if they're safe, and Dewey asks, safe from who? Which I thought was kind of a funny line. Dewey then finds another picture of Maureen, which has "I killed her" written on the back of it. Gail says this is impossible because Stu and Billy killed Maureen, and Dewey is having issues with Kincaid's approach. Dewey gets Sydney's machine as he looks up and sees her enter the station. You know, because she's saying that she's not available right now. Never mind. That was a bad joke.
It's fitting of this movie. So.
Dewey tells Sid that he told her to stay hidden, but Sydney says that the killer has found her. She walks in and Gail hugs her hello and is then introduced to Kincaid. Dewey asks Sydney how the killer could have gotten her number and that Jennifer used his phone, as did Kincaid. So, of course, this whole science fiction thing of the voice being able to change, that means that it could be either of these people. Sydney is upset that she wasn't informed of her mom's involvement, and she wants to see all the pictures that he has. Kincaid's partner is upset, as he thinks Kincaid is just going to get her flowers and candy, as we meet Randy's sister Martha, played by Heather Matarazzo, and she's the one who plays the Deus Ex Machina, as we have a tape of Randy leaving his legacy.
When did he have time to make this, exactly?
How many fucking times are we going to see this shit, boys? Of, oh, he's not here, but here's a tape of him saying what you need to hear.
The only thing that would have been worse was having him, like, introduce Stabs 6 or 7 or whatever, which one they were making. This is... what? Okay, and do I think it's kind of cool to see him? Yes, because I wasn't expecting it. This movie has no idea what it wants to be. I mean, no wonder they're getting faxes of new pages every day. It feels like it. As I'm going along, like, I'm kind of, you know, I'm bumping with it. It's ugly jazz. It doesn't know what it's doing. But when I sit to think about each scene, I'm like, holy shit, this is badly written.
So the only thing that would have been worse if they revealed he survived and like he was the script doctor on Stab 3. That's probably the only thing that would have been more ridiculous than him having this prepared, because it's been also canonically quite some time since he died. So why have they not shown this tape before? He's like, in case there is another killer, I am going to prepare, even after the current murder investigation is still happening, which leads to my death. So on the logic front, of which this movie does not score high marks on, it fails there. And the other problem, and this gets into my larger issue I alluded to earlier, is the whole discussion about trilogies in horror, which, if you know the genre, and in a lot of ways, if you know film in general, trilogies were not that much of a thing in the year 2000s. You have to go to the big examples, Good and Bad and the Ugly. It's a Western trilogy, not applicable. Evil Dead, if you're looking at horror, which I would probably call the biggest like horror trilogy at this point, part of the appeal was that the second one is basically a remake of the first one, and then the third one is its own thing entirely. So it's not telling a continuous story per se outside of having the main protagonist. So even the slashers, Halloween, not a trilogy. We wouldn't get that for another 25 goddamn years. I guess if you're Craven, you're looking at Nightmare 1, 3, and New Nightmare. But that gets ruined if you're looking at New Nightmare, because you have to acknowledge then that it's canon, which I know there's debate on that, and you could poke holes in both. So by introducing this, you're not even sticking to your own genre. And in particular, you're doing it with a trope that has never been associated with horror. Horror trilogies are a rarity, even nowadays, let alone in 2000. So it doesn't work at all.
You know what I really bumped up against in this viewing?
Mm-hmm.
The fact that they randomly bump into this chick, who, by the way, has a trailer on this closed set. How is she here? This is so fucking random. The randomness of it is what I hated about it. And the fact that she actually has this tape all set to play, just in case she runs into Sydney and Gale. I know you gotta go with coincidences in these movies, but this just really rubbed me the wrong way.
And it's magnified because you also have to take into account Sydney's been in hiding.
Yes.
So you're also banking on the fact that she will expose herself.
They had to have planned something else for him in one of the multiple scripts, and they cut the other part out, and this is it. Because I could see using this to lead up to him being another suspect, you know, by the end of the day, but suddenly, no. This is a just because.
Yeah, hold that thought, because Williamson did kick that idea around for next week, so put a pin in that.
And even the whole, like, he talks about the killer's unstoppable by the third movie. Well, if we're going by slasher logic, Freddy's already immortal, so to speak. So he doesn't become Super Freddy until 5. So I can use that joke.
Jesus.
Jason doesn't become supernatural until part 6.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Myers was dead, and even then, the Thorn trilogy, there's a huge portion of the fan base who doesn't like any of those movies.
And by the way, he wasn't even in the third one too. So
yeah, so like now you're really seeing what happens when you take something that was already straining itself a bit with two as far as the rules, and it's being written by a guy who apparently knows nothing about horror.
All right, we kind of went over them, but I want to go ahead and go over what Randy says about trilogies here. He says that true trilogies are about revealing things that we thought were true but weren't. One, the villain is a supervillain. Two, anyone could die, including Sydney. Three, the past will come back to bite you in the ass, so whatever you think you know about the past, you can forget. This is the crux of that video. Sydney tells Martha to be careful. As Gail says, she works better alone. Man,
and if you
man.
Think about also that first rule about, like, in trilogies, you learn things that you thought were true are not. Even Star Wars, the most famous trilogy at this point, yeah, it's there. But it's also kind of illogical when you think about how certain things are said in the Star Wars trilogy. It's the thing of, just because I'm talking louder doesn't mean I'm speaking intellectually. And I feel like this is the writing equivalent of that.
Jennifer approaches Gale yet again, saying starting now, she goes where Gale goes. So they head into the studio offices and start exploring, which is where they find Carrie Fisher, who says that she looks just like Princess Leia, but she's been getting that her whole life, and the one who did get the part slept with George Lucas.
I did not do that to transition into this cameo. It just worked out that way.
It did. Oh my goodness. Adam, more of that sleaze, right? Because this is calling back to those Hollywood couches.
It absolutely is. And look, she made a point of Carrie Fisher, you know, and if you watch some of her stand up and they just released a final one that she did. She talks about the parts where she loved going through it and parts of it where she didn't. The only thing I really liked with seeing her here, one, it feels creepy with the shit we get with Sydney's mother, but knowing the scripts and how this thing seemed to be just Cuisinarted up. For those that know Carrie Fisher and how so many movies only got to screen because she worked on them, I love seeing Carrie Fisher. I adore her. I think she's such an important part of Hollywood beyond what people know, the obvious face roles. But this is a weird, I was not expecting this whatsoever.
Well, a couple things about that. Number one, they didn't have to worry about writing her stuff because she was the one who wrote this dialogue. This is all her. And number two,
it shows. It's good.
Yeah, yeah. Number two, she wasn't their original choice.
No.
Their original choice for this was Jamie Lee Curtis, which, okay. I think Carrie Fisher works out better here. I do laugh. The George Lucas parts, I did find that kind of funny.
You know, I should hate it, but she makes it. It's like trying to get your kid to smile when they're mad at you. Yeah. Where it's like, oh, I can't be mad because she's just naturally gifted as a performer.
Yeah.
And you, when you think about, oh yeah, it's like, you really think she would have slept with George Lucas? No, because she has standards.
That's why she slept with Harrison and the crew.
Now, what I don't like about this cameo is the fact that she kind of gives the crux of what Sydney's looking for, because they show her the pic. Jennifer leaves her ring there, and Fisher leads them into Maureen's files, and we hear that backstory, which includes movies produced by Milton, Lance Henriksen's character. So all of this is just to get the plot moving, and she's used as a plot device, which I didn't like.
Yeah, that's also lazy, but also, if you know, if I'm looking at this from the Star Wars level, Star Wars also has a lot of conveniences like that, where it's only because people are in the right spot that things happen.
Definitely.
So maybe that's why they also got Carrie Fisher.
Maybe.
She's also the only person, and this was a weird time for her also, because remember, she has a cameo in Austin Powers.
Yep.
As the, she's like the therapist. She was doing a lot of just weird, where it's like, okay, why is she here?
By the way, Lance Henriksen wasn't the first choice to be Milton. You know who was going to play this part?
Mm-hmm. Robert Englund.
Wes Craven.
At least that man learned.
Yes.
Quentin Tarantino. He's I tried to put myself in a movie once and never again.
Uh-huh.
Like, he at least learned from his mistake that Tarantino has yet to learn.
Yeah, he made himself into cameos, which was the best way to take Craven in these films. Meanwhile, Sydney hears voices in the bathroom. When she starts exploring with pepper spray in hand, she finds Angelina in the stall trying to find souvenirs. She says she wanted to make Sydney proud and that she wishes it would have worked out. When Sydney tries returning Angelina's brush, she starts walking around until she runs into her on-set house. Now, this just tells you about the frantic nature of this production. Craven hadn't gotten the script yet, but he knew he wanted to do something that kind of calls back to that first film. He had this set built. He basically wrote this scene around the set as opposed to the scene being written and then the set being built. So the fact that we have it here, it's just the how it got here. It blows me away that this thing even saw the light of day. And by the way, from the outside, this house looks suspiciously like the Elm Street house.
Yeah, this kind of reminds me of Freddy vs. Jason when they rebuilt the Elm Street house.
Yeah.
Yep.
Sydney continues to explore and even flashes back to scenes involving her and Billy. Sydney's opening all the doors to places that Ghostface could be hiding, but he actually spreads behind her and pulls her through the window. She again fights him off as she runs up the stairs and climbs further up the set. She then pulls him onto the bed below and then calls for Dewey. She hears her mother's voice, which is saying that she'll protect Sid from the boogeyman, yet she doesn't deserve to be protected. More flashes to past voices as she sees a shape in a sheet saying that she needs protecting. Sydney jumps down and Dewey says that she wasn't supposed to go in that house and it's set up like the murder scene from the first film.
Oh boy. I also love, we have never acknowledged Stab 2.
Nope.
So we've seen the first one and we've seen the third one. So what the hell was the second movie about?
That's a great point. Angelina tells cops that she took the mask as a souvenir as Kincaid drives off with her. Roman is bitching to John Milton and Gail shows up with Dewey and Jennifer to interrogate him about Sid's mom. After some prodding, he starts to remember Maureen and he says that he couldn't tell anyone in the press that he knew her because it would make him a suspect. I will say, I did like Milton calling Gail Lois Lane here. That line kind of made me chuckle a little bit.
Not with that haircut. Superman would leave her with that hairstyle.
No, because he didn't leave Kate Bosworth. Milton says that things got out of hand, and knowing what we know about the producer of this film, as Adam has said, this scene is probably the creepiest thing of the entire series.
This too, I mean, think about it. This series is based around slut-shaming Sydney's mom. This franchise is built on that. That's kind of fucked. Yeah. Not kinda. That is really fucked up.
Well, yeah. It's terrible writing also because you're trying to inform a character who never gets the chance to stand up for herself because she's deceased.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that we're told about her is for the negative. And the problem is, like, this is the opposite of The Sopranos, which I always use as the example. I know it's a different TV's not movies, but fuck off. Let me make my point. If you listen to this movie, this series, they talk a lot about Sydney's mom and a lot of it's exposition. And The Sopranos, they do the same thing with Uncle Dickie all the time. But you know everything you need to know about that character based on the way Tony talks about him and the way information is delivered. It's perfectly done. You get painted a full picture. They devote a lot of time to Maureen Prescott in these movies, but it's just literally and figuratively shits on her in every way. And when you combine it with the fact that the producer is named after the author of Paradise Lost,
mm-hmm.
What are you trying to say with that? You know, a guy who was a writer and a civil servant, you're trying to compare to a sleazy producer?
Meanwhile, Kincaid says that by the third movie, all bets are off and that he knows studios, which is why he wanted this case. He tells Sydney that when you see what he sees every day, you get haunted. It's like seeing ghosts that just don't go away in your head. Kincaid says that he knows how to handle flesh and blood killers. That's catch him or kill him. He then says that his life is his favorite scary movie. Boy, we're really setting him up here, aren't we?
Yeah, this reminds me of, like, they're trying to make him a badass in the way they tried to make Vince Vaughn a tough guy in The Lost World.
Oh, yeah.
Reminds me of that.
Jennifer keeps telling Gail what her Gail would do, and Sydney says that he's going to Milton's to hear what he says about her mom, and Dewey says that it looks like they're going to that party after all. Roman greets them as he's drinking away, and Tyler points out that every time Dewey is in a movie, he almost dies. We hear the "we'll be right back" line as Roman shows Jennifer around the house, and we see a ghost face mask and costume. Dun dun dun. Jennifer calls for Roman at the top of the stairs as Gail tells Dewey to call Sydney. He does, and they hear her phone as they find the voice synthesizer. Dewey and Gail then split up.
That's freaking, like, a tape recorder hasn't caused an actor this much harm since Mel Gibson.
Dewey runs into Tyson, who, boy, he's back after being away for an hour, and Gail searches for Roman. Gail opens a coffin and sees Roman inside with a knife in his chest. Boy, this is quite an intricate setup for being a solo killer, isn't it?
You think?
Jennifer then turns up, as does Angelina, who admits that she didn't fuck Roman to get a lead role only to die here. Oh boy. Ouch.
Oof.
God, I gotta go take a shower after saying that line. Angelina is then stabbed in the chest as the girls run away. Ghostface then appears and stabs Dewey as well as Tyson, who says, "Oh, you motherfucker," as he tries to get away. Tyson's then thrown off the balcony as Jennifer tries escaping. Jennifer is behind soundproof glass, which is hidden by a mirror. Dewey shoots the glass. As Jennifer lands on the ground dead.
It's also the second movie that involves a soundproof room.
Yes, good call.
Yep.
And this movie also makes you think, maybe Dewey should have died in that soundproof room. We would have had one less character to deal with, because for a lot of this movie, he doesn't do a whole lot.
No. Ghostface then grabs Gail, and they tumble down the stairs. Dewey calls for her as his phone rings. He thinks it's Gail, who says that she's trapped in the basement. Ghostface then throws a knife, of which the butt end hits Dewey in the forehead. That was so weird. Like, he can't even hit him with the freaking blade.
Yeah, so now Ghostface isn't the only clumsy moron in this franchise. Now these characters have become bumbling buffoons.
Sydney, meanwhile, wakes up in the police station and goes through her left-out files. She answers her phone and hears her voice echoing, but it's Ghostface, all right, who says it's not who he is, it's who's with him. He asks if there's somewhere they can be alone and that her friend doesn't have to die like the rest of them. He says that he wants her. If she shows her face, then they live. If she runs, they die. He asks if he really wants to know who her mother is before telling her to hang up. She then continues going through her files and finds a gun. She continues to the house, and Ghostface tells her to grab the metal detector and move it around her entire body. She then pulls out the gun, and Ghostface has her throw it into the pool. He says that her friends are inside waiting for her. So she walks in, and he says, now that they're all here, the party can begin. Ghostface appears again as Sydney unloads a clip into him. Dewey cheers, and Ghostface falls, but Gale looks and sees that Ghostface has disappeared. Sid sees Kincaid, who tells her to put the gun down, and Ghostface attacks again. So here's Kincaid to come back for the final act. Like, he disappeared from the police station, but here he is. Kincaid fights him off as Sydney says if he wants her to come and get her. The chase is on as Sydney unloads all the books and finds a secret door to hide in. But there's someone here too, as she hears her mom's voice yet again. This goddamn synthesizer. She asks if she missed her, and she sees the sheet again. Ghostface takes off the sheet, and he tells her that it's time for Sydney to come to terms with her mom and him. And we get another convoluted backstory about how his mom now had a new name, Maureen Prescott. The mask comes off, and dun-dun-dun, it's Roman, who is Sydney's half-brother. I'll save Adam for a second. Matt, how do you feel about this reveal?
You know, for all the discussion about trilogies, how did they miss this one? This is one thing the horror franchise has done, slashes in particular. Killers being related to the main character. Like family ties. Not that family ties, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Look, Laurie and Michael. In Nightmare on Elm Street, Freddy's dead. They reveal long-lost daughter that he was trying to get after. And they never call that in Jamie and Randy's. I keep calling him Jamie because it's fucking, they're one and the same to me. That should be in Randy's rules. By the third movie, the killer is either going to be related to one of you or he will be one of you. See, that's one that's actually would have made sense to include. And it would have made this reveal, if not surprising, at least it would have been somewhat plausibly referred to. As it's depicted here, I think it's really out of place. And this is, to me, as bad and as retconny as making Blofeld to be Bond's brother. With the amount of, like, wheel spinning and it was me all along that we're going to find out. Instead of the Ghostface uniform, we should have been wearing the hood that Vince McMahon wore when he revealed himself as the higher power. Because that's kind of what this is.
All right. Adam?
This is when I realize I'm not watching a horror movie. I'm not watching a Scream movie. I'm not watching a Stab movie. I'm watching a soap opera. That's who wrote this. The acting, it suddenly hits. This is a soap opera. This is a UPN CW late 90s soap opera with the quality other than, I would say, Courtney Cox, David Arquette, and freaking Neve Campbell. The rest of everybody, this is a piss poor soap opera. I don't want to say piss poor because I can enjoy parts of this. We're ripping it apart because this thing deserves to. I'm not hating it as I go along, but it's I can pick this like I'm picking freaking broccoli out of my beef noodles than where they're not supposed to be. It doesn't fit. But suddenly with the brother reveal, I'm like, oh, okay, this is fucking Days of Our Lives. And it's not what I expected it to be.
Okay.
But at the end of the day, I can't stand this. And part of it is because Scott Foley can't sell this.
No, and this is also one, I get the sense when they were developing this movie, they're like, okay, the last two movies we've had multiple killers. We can't do that a third time. But of the three movies, this is the one where I'm like, okay, it's straining plausibility that one person could orchestrate all of this. You almost needed an accomplice. And you had an excuse because this guy's a director who'd be able to hire people.
He did have an accomplice.
Yeah.
In the original script, and they had shot this movie like it was going to be her all along, but they nixed it for a reason I'll get to here in a bit. But it was going mm-hmm. to be Angelina Tyler, who was going to be his accomplice. And yeah. You know what? I was listening to the commentary to this, and I kind of agree with what they were saying there. In the commentary, it was the editor, the producer, and Craven. And the editor and producer were pissed that they had to cut her out because when you think about it, this is Sydney's half-brother, and he would be sleeping with the woman who is playing Sydney in the movie. So he's living out some crazy ancestral fantasy, which is dark and sick, but it's deranged, and it fits in with the Scream series. The reason why they didn't go with the duology like they always do, one word, Columbine. They didn't want any bit of comparison to having two people carry out a plot like this, like what happened the year before in Littleton, Colorado. That is the reason. And that one instance killed off this plot. Look, I'm not saying I would have liked that. What I will say, though, is I kind of like the circumference of it. In the first movie, we had screenwriters carrying everything out. Second movie, you had Laurie Metcalf playing the producer who funded the killings. Here we have the director carrying it out. You know, as somebody who was in the business for a number of years, I do kind of like the circumference of that and the way it plays with the business. And given the fact that we are playing a movie within a movie, if you're going to make it work, that's how you make it work. So I kind of like that. But Adam's absolutely right. Scott Foley cannot sell this whatsoever.
Well, on a conceptual level, that escalation that you're referring to, that's actually a very smart writing device. The problem is that's not at the forefront.
Correct.
What they proceed that with is all the stuff about the mom and making that be the impetus for everything, not the fucked up escalation of failing upwards in Hollywood.
Yeah, and the character is named Roman. I believe that is...
Polanski?
No, that is a play on Roman Coppola, who was Francis Ford Coppola's son, who was also a failed filmmaker. So, I don't know, man. There's parts of this I do really like, but I do think it's kind of miscast because of how he comes off.
So you're saying this should have been Nicolas Cage?
Yeah, that would have been bad. I could have kind of gone with that.
You know, there's parts of this where I can enjoy as I'm going along with it and be like, okay, cool little twist. Okay, it's keeping me guessing. The delivery of how this stuff is done is where I'm like, man, you look at Scream and you had so many new actors and young actors here. You have some people that have done this for a while, but it feels like they're here just to goof around.
Well, and the other part of this that is completely implausible, and look, these are horror films. It's not like we're looking for plausibility, but in these you kind of do because of the way the first one was so well constructed when you think about where the two killers are at the time of each killing. Here he almost has to teleport to be in each killing of this film. Up to when he quote-unquote fakes his death. How does he pull that off? I made a little crack about that earlier, but how the fuck does he pull that off without an accomplice?
And he's a Hollywood filmmaker, so you think like he could have fun with like body doubles.
Yeah.
And you don't have to disclose who they are. Part of the mystery is, oh, he just hired nameless, anonymous people to help him out, and then they faded into obscurity. We never know who they are. There is something kind of sinister about that as an idea for this type of movie. You know, the invisible, the stuff that's not visible to the casual audience, because they're talking a lot about, you know, the way fame is both exploited and exploitative, as we've talked about many times throughout this show. So you really could have, it's like the pieces are here, but Aaron Kruger is not the person to put this puzzle together.
No, and as we've mentioned, Craven's not exactly the best writer either. So you didn't have a Lawrence
Kasdan. No, this is a guy who, much like Spielberg for a long time, could not end a movie to save his life.
Yeah, you don't have a Lawrence Kasdan here to put the pieces together.
Like between Nightmare on Elm Street, I watched Red Eye not too long ago because I just seen Send Help.
Yeah, me and Jen did the same thing.
You know, I learned, like, I'm never going to get on a plane with Rachel McAdams.
Yes.
But that third act is an abomination. I'm talking about Red Eye, not Send Help.
Yeah, no, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
I want to review Send Help so bad because I freaking loved it.
Maybe we'll do the Rachel McAdams duology on planes. Maybe we'll do that. Roman gives a huge monologue about how directors direct and that he had no idea they're going to make films of their own. Meanwhile, Gale and Dewey escape as Sidney says that he got what he wanted and now he needs to die. He pulls out Milton and gives another monologue about how Milton worked her to the bone before Roman gives Milton's final cut to the throat. Dewey and Gale, they go through the wrong door as Foley comes off more whiny than my cat, and Sidney tells him to take some fucking responsibility. Now, Adam, you have been very vocal throughout this series of saying you like how Neve Campbell has been playing the victim. She's not really the damsel in distress. How do you feel she's coming off here in this finale?
I like that she's still not a pushover. At the end of the day, she's going to stand up and fight. She's still, when she's faced with Ghostface, she's not running, hiding, even expecting anybody else to do it. Like, she's there to fight. She's there to be the one to kill him. And even the third film in, that's what I want. I'm almost here to watch Sidney Prescott attacking Ghostface as I am to see Ghostface killing teenagers.
The fight is on until Sidney is knocked down. Roman tries choking her out as he electrocutes himself. Kincaid is then taken down as Sidney comes at Roman with a knife. He, however, has a gun and shoots her down twice. But when he looks over, she's gone. He starts...
Did anybody think whatsoever that she was dead when she got shot?
No.
there was just no surprise there. No. I didn't know if it'd be a through or what it was, but there was no suspense of me thinking he actually killed her.
No, especially because you've already revealed that this movie, people finally learned what a bulletproof vest is.
Yeah, right. Roman starts taking the room apart looking for her as Gale and Dewey start getting closer. Remember these phones, guys? These big ass fucking cell phones.
That should have been the murder weapon instead of a knife, because that thing is like, it's like a brick.
His Zach Morris phone.
That's like a King novel, that fucking phone. He calls
this. No, because the difference is that this phone I'd want to actually pick up.
Will you
stop? The phone works.
Jesus Christ. I knew you were going to fucking get a dig in. He calls Sid's phone as she comes at him, showing him that she's wearing a vest. He says that he still has to make his movie as she stabs him right in the heart, and Dewey and Gale finally make their way in. Sidney says that the killer wasn't superhuman, as Roman stands up and screams, and Sid screams for Dewey to shoot him in the head. Adam, how do you feel about this finale?
That pop-up ruined the end for me.
Did it?
Stop doing that over. Like, it's a trope once. It's a callback again. It's stupid a third time. To him to pop up, it made no sense to me. I just, stop it. And then Dempsey is still here at the end for what? Because they bring, this is one of the days they were shooting that he happened to be on set for. So I dug the end. I dug the fight. I liked her standing up and the way that it happened. That pop up though, it took away the smile I had.
Well, the one thing I don't like is you have two cops in this movie, and one of them has to be told to aim for the head.
Yeah.
you fucking morons.
We cut to Dewey and Gale living the simple life together once again as Sydney walks her dog. Dewey asks Gale to sign the book that he has for him, and when she opens the flap, it's an engagement ring. God damn, I should have used this trick.
Aww.
He asks her to marry
him. Yeah, I mean, they're really going to be ready to rumble.
Give it a week.
They're not, no longer are they going to be just friends.
Oh, Jesus.
I'm sorry, I'll be here for you.
She calls him a brave man. He replies that he's really scared. She kisses him and places the ring on her finger as Sid and the dog walk in the gate. She goes in the house as Kincaid. They bring him here for this. Was there any chemistry between him and Sid? I know he had eyes for her, but this was just weird to see him with a sling right here.
No, and it's like, damn, she moved off Jerry O'Connell's death really quick.
Kincaid tells Sid that they're about to start a movie. She asks what kind of movie as the door opens seemingly by itself.
Yeah, the door should have burst open and it was Creed.
Sid walks away, leaving it open as credits roll on Scream 3, boys. Oh, what a plot. Adam, how'd you feel about this final prologue here?
I mean, I guess you put your pretty people together at the end of a movie because reasons. It made no fucking sense whatsoever. I like the metaphor of her being willing to leave the door open. It's a change of pace for Sydney. I appreciate that, especially if this was supposed to close it off.
I think it was more than supposed to. I clearly think this was done to be the end of this series.
I agree. Nobody here would want to come back for this one, let alone a fourth one. But 11 years later, that's exactly what we get. But until we get there, scale of 1 to 10, what do we give Scream 3? Mr. Bunch, my best friend for over 30 years, you go ahead, sir.
Picked this thing apart, made fun of it, criticized it, questioned its relevance and reason for being. That said, you're in for a penny, you're in for a pound, so you're going to watch these. There's some enjoyment to be had. You got some decent casting. They got pulled out, even if they don't do great things. It's nice to see specifically Nev Campbell, Cox, and Arquette back for this. They surprised me with Liev Schreiber at the beginning, so that was, you know, you got me there. Dempsey shows up to not show up, so that's an utter waste. You know, Scott Foley, he's a decent freaking Smallville character that shows up in this, which is kind of what he is till he's evil, but he doesn't have the chops to pull it off. So this thing is just, it's kind of all over the place. I can't say that I'm a big fan, but I can't say that I hate it. But it keeps going back and forth between being meta to itself and a parody to itself. And I think that's the problem, is that it is so confused on how it wants to be poignant about Hollywood, but at the same time criticize itself, and it doesn't do it well. And the way that it insults women in the industry, I think was despicable back then. And after the Me Too movement, after Harvey Weinstein, after so many things, that I'm literally going, you all kind of made this about Natalie Wood. This is so bad. And that's how far back some of this goes. That part just feels really, it makes you want to take a shower as you get to the third act, because that just feels so dirty and unclean. The soap opera quality of this makes it lesser, you know, but I'm glad that the leads came to play. I'm glad that your stars came back to do another one. And if this was the end, not great, but not horrible either. I'm going to give it a 6. It's worth watching if you're watching the other two. You could end with one, but if you're going to watch two, you might as well keep going. So 6 on 10, it's a ho-hum sequel.
One thing before I get to Matt, did you watch this with Maddie?
I did not, because she had beat me to it.
I would be curious to have how she thinks of it too. Did she say what she thought of it?
She thought it was only okay. She liked two. She kind of defends two like I do. She thought that this one got a little hokey, but that two was worth watching.
All right. Wow. 6 out of 10 from Mr. Bunch. Mr. Goudreau, how do you feel, sir?
More like a ho-hump sequel, given what both the subtext and the actual text are trying to illustrate. To Adam's point, though, and I think he kind of summarized my thoughts in a smaller, condensed way, I don't hate this movie like I do with a lot of bad slasher sequels. I mean, go back, well, I can't say go back to some of those Texas Chainsaw reviews because they've been lost to the sands of time. And before you ask, no, I'm not watching those movies again, everybody, so fuck off with putting me through that again. That even still, I'd be willing to give it more of a pass with the production issues and the constant rewrites and overhauls if the movie didn't repeatedly acknowledge them and try to wink-wink as an excuse, like when a cop pulls you over to give you a ticket and you think kissing their ass will get you out of it. It doesn't really work for me. And yeah, with the Me Too movement and all the allegations, I mean, especially you had one of the stars of the first movie take a $100,000 settlement as a result of certain actions, and then to have a whole movie about that to literally exploit it in a lot of ways, I think makes this movie age horribly in a way beyond just the soundtrack and Courtney Cox's haircut. I don't know what you say to your stylist to get that cut outside of I fucked your child, because that's kind of the level of just like butchery that you see on her head. And honestly, it's so bad that it makes David Arquette's wrestling attire look presentable to the eyes. And if you saw what he wrestled in, that's not a positive statement. But I'll say this, I'd rather watch this than watch anything Jeff Jarrett did in 2000, so that's a positive. And for all of its faults, it's not boring, but I don't think it's focused, and I don't think if Williamson stayed on, I don't think this would have been a great movie, but I think it would have at least been a little bit more intellectual with what it was trying to send up. And when you have someone in Kruger who, outside of The Ring, I don't think has brought a lot of quality to his screenwriting repertoire, you're left with this. The tagline's correct. The most terrifying scream is always the last, because it's terrifying that people thought this was good enough to put on screen. It's a 4. You know, it's certainly the weakest of the three, and I think it's by a decent margin, but Garrett, to your point, and I'm sure you can back me up on this, we've seen far worse. But that also goes to show just the depths of quicksand and shit that the horror genre can sometimes subject you to. But I still don't think I can give it any, like I said, any excuses or leniency for its sloppiness.
All right, so you're landing on a 4?
Yep, I'm going to land on a 4.
All right, so a 4 from Matt. You know, one of the unfortunate things, and a big reason I really wanted to start this podcast and start doing series like this about doing it, is in order to give the backstory and things, you got to kind of dig into how the movie got made, who was behind it, what happened behind the scenes. It was with a girlfriend who never ever wanted to hear anything about what happened behind the scenes. And every time I would try to bring it up, she would yell at me and tell me, just stop it. I don't care. But I was trying to put myself in the mindset of, what if I was a person who had no idea about the script changes? I had no idea about the frantic nature of this. I had no idea that nobody besides Cox and Arquette wanted to come back for this. Would I find some enjoyment out of this? And, you know, if I think about it in that instance, I kind of can. I am warmer on this than I was the time that me and Matt reviewed this 5-6 years ago. I found some of these kills kind of fun. I thought most of them, with the exception of Sarah Darling's death, were pretty good kills. I got some enjoyment out of them as a horror fan. Where I bump up against it is the overcompensation producers made to not have the duology of the killers, because it makes a lot of this movie just make no sense. There's no way this killer can teleport the way some of these deaths happen. And when I think about it in those terms, I really bump up against it. I got more enjoyment out of the finale than I thought I would. And when I thought about the fact that this is a director doing this as opposed to the other two movies, I think there's some creativity behind that. I really do. And I know I'm saying that about an Aaron Kruger script. Maybe it was a Craven rewrite, but I like that circumference. But overall, it's really tough to watch this, and it's really tough to see that Gale and Dewey, as much as I like them as characters, I don't like them being the center of a film. And with Neve Campbell being gone the majority of this shoot, it shows. And to Adam's point that he's been making this entire series, I like Neve Campbell in these movies a whole hell of a lot. And when you have her for 2-3 scenes, it just doesn't have any impact. And I said a lot of bad things about last week's film, but the consistent thing about that was Neve Campbell. Here, she's here. I like the way they introduce her, but when she disappears, you feel it. So we all have different scores, which I actually kind of like. You know, and I had this written down, so it's not like I'm making it up on the spot. I'm giving this movie a 5. I think there's enough enjoyment out of it where I think any horror fan could find some enjoyment. But by the end, you're giving a lot of what the fucks. Like, how did this happen? What happened here? Also, to kind of piggyback on what both of you have said, when you look back on this movie, when we think about what was revealed 9-10 years ago, you just feel gross. It's like watching any Jeffrey Epstein biography. Watched a couple of those this week on Netflix, and after they're over, I just want to take a fucking shower. And you're telling on yourself in this movie as well, which really makes it age terribly, to Matt's point. So 5 out of 10, that was actually a higher score than I was expecting to give Scream 3. But after Scream 3, nobody was set to come back. Wes Craven was going to make Elite Pictures, but by the time 2011 rolled around, everybody's egos got in check. And we have Scream 4 come out. I was there opening weekend under circumstances I will reveal next week. I will save the newbie for last. Matt, what are you expecting when we review Scream 4 next week?
Well, let me say this. For obvious reasons, this was the first one I saw in the theater. But I was surprised that they made a Scream 4. Not only was I surprised, I was also surprised that everybody came back. I thought there would have been at least one holdout, or at the very minimum, it would have been a different director. So the fact that it was coming out, I wasn't excited because, as I mentioned in the first show, I admire the first one, but it's not one of my favorite horror movies by any stretch. But when I looked at it from the bird's eye view, I actually felt this was one of those times where a franchise's return was actually justified, given the state of horror and how much it had changed in the 11 years. So you can't say A, they didn't wait long enough, and B, there wasn't a need to do another one, especially if you, like me, don't like 3 and were kind of upset that it's the last one. It was kind of cool they were getting a second stab at a finale. And little did we know that we'd have 3 more after this one.
And a TV series, which we'll discuss. All right, Adam, as a newbie, what are you expecting when we get to Scream 4 next week?
For me, I didn't see it. I knew this movie had come out, and I knew that if you save the cheerleader, you saved the world. that's all I knew. I knew nothing about this movie except that Hayden Panettiere was in it. I don't really remember the marketing other than her, because for some reason she had this big freaking swell around that time. But other than that, I know nothing, so it's going to be really freaking interesting. I didn't even know until I was grabbing notes for it that Wes Craven came. I am blown away that Wes Craven is back for 4. Like, that just mind-boggling to me. So I cannot wait to discuss it.
The year before this, he had made probably the worst movie of his career. We'll talk about that when we get...
No, I think it definitively is, which we'll talk about next week.
Oh, my God. Oh. One of the first reviews I did. We'll get to that. But, all right, until next week, when we talk Scream 4... All I know about podcast series is that by the 3rd one, all bets are off. Thank you, boys.
The past will come back to bite you in the ass. Whatever you think you know about the past, forget it. The past is not at rest. Any sins you think were committed in the past are about to break out and destroy you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Wow. That was intense.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Watch a few movies, take a few notes. It was fun.
But Ash, we're gonna carry on and plan the sequel, because let's face it, baby, these days, you gotta have a sequel!
If you like this retrospective review, check out our archives at percolatedmedia.net, as we have tons of franchise reviews such as the Alien film series, the Pirates of the Caribbean film series, the Exorcist films, the Jaws franchise, the Predator films, the film adaptations of author Stephen King, the John Wick franchise, the Jurassic Park and Jurassic World film series, the Beetlejuice films, the Megan films, and so much more.
The reason I'm here is to help you.
Scream retrospective introduction performed by Adam and Sarai, directed by Garrett. Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett and Matt.
It could be fucking Reservoir Dogs by the time this thing is through.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
By definition alone, they're inferior films.
It's bullshit generalization. Many sequels have surpassed their original.
Oh, yeah?
Name one.
Yeah.
Aliens. Far better than the first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's no accounting for taste.
Thank you, Ridley Scott rules.
Scheduling done by Matt.
What did you just say?
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
This is all because of you.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
So how can I help you? Or do you want me to tell you who you look like?
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Now welcome to the final act.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production. Copyright 2026, and any and all music, movie, and sound clips are used for entertainment purposes and review only.
These sick fucks, you've seen one too many movies.
Nah, Sid! Don't you blame the movies! Movies don't create psychos! Movies make psychos more creative!
So in closing, let me say, good luck, Godspeed, and for some of you, I'll see you soon.
All right, Matt, give me a countdown. We shall get going.
Sorry, I'm just reading the track, the bands on the soundtrack, and I'm laughing. Like, are we just reviewing The Punisher again?
Oh, 90s and early 2000s soundtracks. Mm-hmm. Which fucking Blade 2 was on TV yesterday, so I kept watching. And I'm like, the soundtracks of this, Queen of the Damned, fucking that first XXX, like, there's just, oh boy, I own them all.
All right, 3, 2, 1.
Scream 3.
So within a couple months, David Arquette would go from the co-lead in Scream 3 to the co-lead of Ready to Rumble to WCW World Heavyweight Champion. And that is the least embarrassing thing on his resume of those three.
Well, you know what's just as embarrassing is that Ready to Rumble is the one I saw in movie theaters, not in three.
Oh my God, you saw Ready to Rumble in theaters?
You're damn right I did.
I didn't see Ready to Rumble in theaters.
I haven't seen Ready to Rumble, period. I'm a wrestling fan.
Really? Wow. To be honest, I watched it the first time.
When we actually get to WCW 2000, if I don't already put a bullet in my head by that point, we should review it as like a tie-in to Spring Stampede or whatever pay-per-view that was.
We could do that.
Do that in Mr. Nanny.
Oh, no. I'm the Hogan fan of this, and I would never, even I would never put myself through
it. No, we'll do the Hogan Zeus movie, the whatever
No
that
Holds
was.
Barred. No Holds Barred. That no one I would barred. Do. That yes. one I would be in. Yeah, David Arquette. Definitely.
So maybe that's why they also got Carrie Fisher?
Maybe.
She's also the only person, and this was a weird time for her also, because remember she has a cameo in Austin Powers?
Yep.
As the, she's like the therapist. She was doing a lot of just weird, where it's like, okay, why is she here?
Jay and Silent Bob, wasn't she in that too?
Jay and Silent Bob Strikes Back, yeah. She shows up. Yep.
Yeah, well, that was also weird because they got her and Mark Hamill for that.
Yes, and never together. That was, but she threatened Harvey directly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she was known that a friend of hers was victimized, and she sent him a message in a tiny little box and said, if I ever hear something similar again, there's going to be a part of you in this box. And for her to be on this, knowing what she knows about the producer of this film, mind blown.
That was after this, though, wasn't it? I thought that was like 5 years later.
I don't know.
That happened. I don't know. By the way,
I'm just annoyed that outside of Aliens, we only talk about shitty Lance Henriksen
movies. I know.
As opposed to,
hey, the ones I worked on. I worked on two movies with him. He was a delight.
Yeah. Hey, we got Near Dark. We got See if I can count more than on one hand.
I say you got to get past a hand.
Okay, so you got besides Alien, so I don't get Aliens, I don't get Terminator. So I'll give you Near Dark. I will say Dead Man. Shit, I'm at two.
Pumpkinhead. I would fight for Pumpkinhead any day of the week.
Would you give me Hard Target?
Oh yes, for sure.
Okay, I got three.
I'll give you Millennium as a series.
Will you give me Quick and the Dead?
Yep, absolutely.
And shit, I think that's it. Tarzan, if that counts.
Meanwhile, Sydney hears voices in the bathroom.
All right, that's enough. That'll be a wrap. The sequel discussion to be continued.